Welcome to The Colorcast, a show about color grading, color science, and post-production. We are the Coloristos. I'm Jason Myris, a colorist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Josh Pitok, a colorist also in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist in New York City. And guys, I just have like one question for you.
What's that?
What the LUT?
What
the
in the LUT? LUT. Period.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of funny references one could make with that sentence.
But you know what? On Twitter, on forums, in other podcasts, I keep hearing, catching people talking about LUTs. From my perspective, they're a tool, and they're usually best used for a specific purpose. But it seems like people use them for all kinds of reasons, and sometimes that term is used interchangeably. And I thought maybe it'd be good for us to have a conversation about, you know, what LUTs are, why we use them, why we like using them, why we dislike them being used in maybe the inappropriate ways. And I think that would be an informative conversation for people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of sort of what we'll call circumstantial postings on the internet about how people are using them. And I think a lot of people, their definition of what a LUT is depends on their first contact with one, you know?
Right. And really what it's intended to be used for too. Well, you know, where they originally came from and why we use them. And even more so is like, I think that LUTs are also the way to unlock the way the camera is supposed to look, the way everything looked in the field as well. So when Alexa came out and stuff like that, and everyone decided, oh, I want to see what this, unlock the potential of this. That's where I think a lot of people started with, oh, this is why we need a LUT, is to be able to see exactly what was shot in camera.
Right. So let's define it. I mean, how should we define it? Or at least for people who are very inexperienced, how can we help them understand quickly so they can...
Well, let's just really quickly tell people what LUT is, because it's an acronym, which I think is important.
Right.
And so it's an acronym that stands for lookup table. And it's really actually a mathematical concept, which is, it's the idea of having a pre-calculated set of values in a matrix that you can look up and find the corresponding output value, right? So, and rather than having to run a formula every time you want to do a multiplication table, rather than having to multiply that in your head, you can have all the multiplication tables spelled out in a matrix format, in a spreadsheet, for example, and then you just have to look up. So what's 7 times 7? It's 49.
But sometimes that's exactly what the LUT would be telling you.
Yeah.
You're like, oh yeah, 7 times 7 is green.
It's 49. It's whatever. So the idea here is that the LUT as a concept, it's a very simple concept, which is just a series of numbers that have been pre-calculated for you so you can look up the current value and have a modified output value rather than having to do some calculation to figure it out. It's already been done for you. Now, that can mean a lot of things. So one thing, like you mentioned, Josh, is a viewing LUT. Another thing it can be is a transform LUT to change you from one transform you from one color space to another. You can have a calibration LUT that takes your display and takes the values that are wrong in your displays and modifies them so your display is actually showing the correct value. And all of these things are legitimate uses for these LUTs. They're very, you know, standardized usage for LUTs. They're broadly different applications. You know, they're not really the same thing, but it just happens to be in the same format.
And then there's also 1D and 3D LUTs. So how would you define those, Juan, if you were to a quick explanation?
Well, 1D LUTs are more simplistic. So it's taking each color value on its own and giving you an output. So you have a set of values for red, a set of values for green, and a set of values for blue, but they're all unique and separate. The 3D LUTs interact. It's like the three channels are interacting. So you have basically a whole value for what the total color is as opposed to the component colors is. Which means, if you can imagine, you know, if you have, let's say, an 8-bit image, you have 256 steps of each color channel, each red, green, blue color channel. So there's however many possible outcomes, but they're limited to 256 for each color channel. Where if you take those, if you take that in three dimensions and you consider all three channels at the same time, you have 256 times 256 times 256 possible combinations. So it's a much more complex sort of LUT.
And then speaking of that too, one more extension is like sort of like how many points are in your LUT, right? So you have like a, let's say a 17-point LUT or you know, and all the variations regarding sort of the resolution of the LUT, right?
So when we get into 3D LUTs, we stop. You know, with 1D LUT, you can account for every single possible value, even in a 10-bit image. That's only 1,024 possible values for each color channel. It's 3,072 possible values. So it's relatively straightforward to account for all of those, even in a 10-bit image or even in a 16-bit image. If you're dealing with 1D LUTs, you can account for those values very straightforwardly. When you start dealing with 3D LUTs, where you're looking at the combination of all the values, the number of possible input values becomes astronomical. It's tremendous. So there's no way to account for all of those possible permutations of various color combinations. So instead, we sort of subsample those LUTs, and that's what the measurement of the cube by. So the 17 by 20 by 21 by 27 by cube. Those are measurements of how many steps within each color channel we're measuring.
And in terms of where you start to get into a LUT that's fairly capable, that's probably what, like a 17 point LUT?
This really depends on what you're trying to do, This is part of the trick of it. So, you know, for example, with film, let's talk about one specific use of LUTs, which is film emulation LUTs, right? The FPE, film print emulation. FPE LUTs are designed to basically allow colorists to grade underneath the LUT, and with the idea of that image being then printed out the film. On a negative and usually an interpositive and a positive print format, and so it's accounting for the entire chain of the actual printing process for the film, the stock that it's being printed on, the stock that it's being transferred to, and on and on and on. And so that LUT then emulates the entire process. So in theory, you're able to grade underneath that LUT and know exactly what the output is going to be when you get to your final print. And it's, you know, it's never spot on, but it's usually pretty close.
Just so people understand, when you're describing the idea of grading underneath the LUT, that's the idea that you're grading before the LUT. Is that correct?
Grading underneath the LUT is you're grading. So with those film print emulation LUTs, you put that LUT up as the last part right. of your process. And the reason for that is so that you can eventually take that LUT off and then export files for your lab and have your film prints made that way. This is all, I mean, with the news, I think this week that, you know, Deluxe has shut down its lab in LA. Mm. Like, this is all kind of archaic technology. And actually, it segues nicely into one of the things that I think is being misappropriated from those LUTs is people are using those LUTs as a way to get, like, a film look. Right. But those LUTs weren't really meant to FPE LUTs specifically, weren't really meant to simulate a film look so much as the entire process, the chain of the film printing process. So the idea was you would work underneath these LUTs and you'd be able to see your image as it would be on the print, make decisions about what it would look like, and then you could take the LUT off, send those files out to your lab, get them printed, get the positive print made, and then have a screening, and you would see pretty much what you intended to see. Now, when getting beyond that, what we've done since then with the advent of like the whole digital distribution in film is, you know, a lot of DIs were done where the film print emulation LUT was done underneath the grade for the purposes of the film print version of the film, but then that LUT was also applied into the image and then exported out for DCP or what have you as part of the look of the film or the finishing of the film so that the final rendered digital version of the film, which wasn't printed to film, would look like what the film print version was intended to look like. This has been done in the past on shows that, for example, didn't want to spend the money on having the film master print rescanned back in so that they could then make Blu-rays and make Netflix deliverables and make whatever else they need to make from that film set.
Right, and it doesn't even have to be in the software either. It could be through the monitor, it could be through the projection, it could be used in a Davio box or wherever you decide in the chain it wants to be used. So, but that's interesting that you know, they applied this LUT at the very end of the chain just because everyone was that was the only way to get to that look.
Yeah, and not only that, but a lot of those times, like if you're working in a facility that has a built-in lab. Like you're probably just profiling your projector. You're not really calibrating your projector,
right?
And then you're creating a LUT that accounts for your projector. So that LUT, which was very specifically designed to be used in that specific room on that specific projector, was really serving two purposes. It would be a film print emulation LUT, and it would also be a calibration LUT,
right?
But that would be a LUT that would only work in that room on that device. I think the key piece of information that you need when you're looking at whether you need a LUT or not, or whether the LUT that you're using is the correct one for you, is understanding what was the LUT intended to have as an input value, and what was the LUT intended to produce as an output value. And if you don't know those two pieces of information, you're just kind of throwing stuff at a wall rather than actually using a tool. The way it was intended to be used.
I mean, a lot of I've heard this story many, many times over, that a lot of facilities are very they're very cagey about the LUTs that they own internally too. They really don't want to let them out. They have some special secret sauce that they put into their LUTs. But really, to me, what it's saying, based on what you're bringing up as well, is they just don't want them to be used in the wrong ways. Because if they send a LUT out, you don't know necessarily how the input value is going to be used by somebody else. And you don't know what the output value is going to be for that matter as well.
Precisely. I mean, I think, going back a few years, what used to happen is you would make a contract with a lab to do the master print of your film, and they would usually sell you a LUT that they would then author for you that accounted for the specific stocks that you were contracted to use, and accounted for your display. And so it would be a LUT that was made specifically for you, and you'd usually pay some thousands of dollars for that LUT. And it was a service, and you would pay a fee, and you would get that LUT and be able to use it to then grade for that print. And there's shops that are, shops that have end-to-end capabilities that don't really want those LUTs going out, because those end-to-end capabilities may include some revelations about the processing that they use that they don't want going out, you know?
So let me bring up this as well. We should probably discuss what LUTs are not as well. You can't do any secondaries with them. You can't do any windows with them or anything like that, to my knowledge.
What you're limited by is anything that manipulates pixels around the pixel. Anything that adjusts the color value of one specific pixel, you can generally do, but you can't do things that affect pixels around it. Or don't affect pixels around it. For example, windows, you can't do any kind of shapes. Forget shapes. You can do anything in an LGG primary or log primary type grade, contrast, offset, lift gamma gain, red, green, blue combinations on lift gamma gains. Those generally work. You can do qualifiers as long as you're not using any kind of blur or averaging that is going to affect the pixels around the pixels that are selected. If you're doing a straight-up qualifier that's just affecting the pixels that you are selecting, then those can carry through as well. But you can't do anything like blurs or sharpens. You can forget those. Anything kind of geometric or spatial, you can forget. Noise reduction, can't do it. I think I saw a post once, I forget where, somebody was like, my noise reduction isn't carrying through on my LUTs. I don't understand why. Because it's analyzing the image itself, and you can't have any analysis or any kind of calculation in the LUT. The LUT is only able to produce mathematical values. This value coming in, that value going out.
So the question ends up being, why do things like Osiris or even, Blackmagic has some emulation LUTs based, they're bundled in with the software. So have you guys used them? And what do you think of them?
I haven't really used those specific LUTs just because I feel like I can get better results myself, and I'm pretty happy with the results. One thing I do like about the Blackmagic LUTs is they very consciously mention what color space and white point the input value is intended to be. You know, those LUTs say, you know, it's like Fuji, whatever, Rec. 709. It's meant to work in a Rec. 709 image. It's not meant to work on a P3 image or an ASUS or in some other color space. It works in Rec. 709 color space. You're not going to be putting in Alexa Log C directly into that. You got to take that Alexa Log C, make it look the way you want it to look on a 709 monitor. Then you can apply the film emulation LUT. Then you'll get the expected result.
Right.
That's how the LUTs work. It's the expected input and then the expected output. If it's expecting a P3 input and expecting to spit out a 709 output, you're not going to get the results you want if you're just trying to grade in a P3 environment or a 709 environment.
Like I use the Osiris LUTs. It's actually, but I don't use them in the way maybe that they're intending. What I'll generally do is just use them as a way to generate ideas. Like you're kind of spent on an image. You go, well, what would happen if I threw this on? And you go, oh, okay, whoa, it's putting some blue over here where I didn't expect it to do that. That's kind of a good idea. You delete the LUT and then you just start, you know, going in that direction because it puts things somewhere where you wouldn't necessarily just decide to put things. So in that way, I like it just for idea generation, but not necessarily as like an end all be all, like just throw this on and it's going to look like, you know, Tri-X or something like that.
Jason, what about you? Do you use LUTs at all in your workflow or?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's been really interesting is I've gotten into Lustre in the last, let's say, year and a half or so, and Lustre has a really nice, like, LUT browser, we'll say. So one of the things that's been a trick, though, is that everything is a kubelet. So in terms of, you know, how LUTs are distributed, there's a popular format. So the popular format is .cube, but what Lustre uses is 3DL. And so I've had adventures recently with LUTs using a Python program called PyLUT, P-Y-L-U-T, to convert all of those .cube LUTs I have. For instance, I've gotten a number of free ones like you guys have off the web. And then, you know, sort of Vision Color and a number of the others that are popular. And I've converted them to Lustre. And I've been doing a lot of experiments recently because Lustre has a LUT browser for every shot's input that is very easy to sort of quickly try out a lot of LUTs. So I probably have about 100 now. And there's probably about one from each of the collections that I really like. So for instance, I might not like all of the Osiris LUTs, but I do like a number of like a number of Bleach Bypass LUTs are really nice. I've had a lot of people that want a very drained look in their music videos and stuff like that. And so those create a really nice starting point that is a fun creative place to begin with so that you can do something highly stylized. So that's been what I've been doing with LUTs. So
yeah, I think Bleach Bypass brings an interesting idea, which is, you know, that's a very specific kind of style and process. It's interesting that I think that comes up because that's one of the easiest ones to my mind to like just create. You know, you can very easily do a Bleach Bypass look,
right?
In the grade. So, but you see a lot of these things in popping up in LUTs that are like, I feel like it's kind of a shorthand for learning how to grade. You know, and I think this is where you get a lot of kind of the antipathy for LUTs from some of the, like, you know, experienced colorists is I think they get frustrated with the idea of it makes it seem as though grading is just a paint by the numbers, you know, just click through different variations till you find one that you like process, which is very much not what it is. And so I think that that impression that creates is a bit troublesome because then people get frustrated and you get questions like, you know, you'll get people asking like, oh, I just watched Rush and it looked amazing and I want to know how can I make my Canon footage look like Rush. What LUT can I use?
Osiris. Of course.
Yeah, it's not, you know, it's not a matter of throwing a LUT on. It's much more complex than that. It's about understanding the image, understanding how to manipulate it and how to build it out, and understanding what the expectation is from the audience or what the response is going to be to particular things. And understanding the technical process of how film prints are made and how that processing is done and what can happen on film. It's much more complicated than just, oh, here's a LUT I'm going to throw on, and oh, that looks cool, I like it, or not. And that's where you get into the look LUT debate, I think, you know, where there are all these people online selling, usually very cost effectively, like they're not generally very expensive, what amounts to a cure-all. It's like, you know, we're going to make your footage look great. You just buy our LUTs, you know, our set of 20 LUTs or 100 LUTs, and you try them on, and here's one amazing blockbuster look. Here's another amazing blockbuster look, as if it's just a process of trying these various LUTs and finding one that fits.
The one thing I look at it, though, is like sort of a method of what we'll call containerizing someone's ideas and making it easily transferable. So, you know, this is sort of maybe dumbing it down a little bit, but a LUT can, in a certain sense, be like a preset that allows you to get to a base point that you can then explore, you know, off of. And so that's the thing that I found really interesting is, for instance, people have put up LUTs that they've created, and the LUTs are heavily weighted with their creative style. And there's a number of people that have posted LUTs that had a bleach bypass. And I can just say that, let's say, all four or five of the bleach bypass LUTs I have are all sort of quite different, although the theme is similar. And so what's been really eye-opening about that and useful is to see people's takes on bleach bypass. So the thing that's been really fun about that is to find where bleach bypass could possibly go from somebody who's got a lot of experience, and the way that they transferred that knowledge was to containerize it into a LUT. And I think there's definitely a place where a person could leave the LUT in place and largely do nothing else. But I think there are a lot of places in the creative world where, you know, presets or pre-configured creative ideas, whether it be a template or anything like that, are a popular way for people to get in the ballpark. But then almost everyone is going to do something with it above and beyond that. I highly doubt, you know, people get into color to just apply LUTs, render out, and leave.
I have three words for you, and we've all been doing this long enough to know this. Kai's Power Tools. Now, what image does that put in your mind? Really, really bad Photoshop.
Right.
During those years of like, oh God, when was that? Like the late 90s, early 2000?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It was like you would go out on the web and you would be like, oh my God, that's Kai's Power Tools. And that's kind of what freaks me out about some of the LUTs too, because you go, oh man, okay, there's that Osiris LUT. That's what they did with this. And so, I mean, not to bag on it or anything, but I mean, with having that stuff, there's a big ability to abuse it as well.
But the one thing that I would say, though, is that the LUT is not at fault for that. You know,
no.
It's
sure.
just
no,
like
no.
Any of the other things that are available to people to use and then either work off of
right.
or leave alone. You know, it's the person that didn't get more creative.
For sure.
And you bring up an excellent point, which is, I mean, a lot of people kind of use the term LUT negatively in the same way that people are using it kind of positively, in a way that is inappropriate and takes out of context what it is. A LUT is just a tool, right? It's just a bunch of numbers.
That's
so,
right.
You know, the what people take issue with is not the math or the tool. It's the way the tool is being used or mishandled. And so I think that, and I'm guilty of this too. I think I sometimes, in this conversation, I referred to LUTs as being a problem or implying that LUTs are a problem. And it's not really the LUT that's the problem. It's the it's the conceptualization of the idea that grading is a process of trial and error or presets that I think is misleading. You know, what ends up happening, I think the Kai Power Tool is a good example, but it was part of the desktop publishing revolution.
Right.
And I think we're seeing it now in editorial as well, where, you know, anybody can edit now. You know, the idea of a craftsman editor is becoming more and more sort of marginalized. A lot of stuff that used to take a technical expertise to do in terms of editorial now is being done by people without a lot of technical expertise. You know, being able to edit video in some functions of media is now the equivalent of being able to run Word. You know, it's just, you're just expected to be able to do this. And perfectly reasonably so, because the tools are relatively easy to use. And I think that you can see a natural progression of that towards color, which is, you know, if you if you sell something as a LUT, as a quick fix for bad images, then you end up with a situation where people are misusing those functions and actually producing worse results, like what we saw in the desktop publishing and what we're seeing in editorial and what we've seen in music creation. Oh my God! You know, like since like music creation software has become cheap and affordable or even free, there's just if you look at the kind of the non-curated music, like the stuff that's not on iTunes, but just the stuff that's out there on the internet that people are sharing and creating, the vast majority of it is god awful, and that's because anybody can use the tools. Doesn't mean that anybody should use the tools necessarily.
Yeah,
it's true. Well,
it's kind of like there's that NRA saying. It's, you know, guns don't kill people; people kill people. it's kind of like, you know, LUTs don't ruin movies; people ruin movies.
That's very much true, and I think we make a mistake when we start talking about LUTs. And it's a perfectly understandable mistake because it's an easy one to make because it's such a general term and it can mean so much. But we make a mistake when we start talking about LUTs as being the culprit. It's not the LUTs, it's the misuse of the LUTs.
Well, what are some great sort of, you know, without argument, like what are the great, you know, places where people can use LUTs in an effective way that isn't necessarily just sort of, you know, a shortcut? Where they're really critical and helpful.
Yeah, I'll give three examples where I use them. So one that I don't necessarily do regularly, but I use sometimes, are the LUTs that manufacturers make specifically for their cameras, like RAW cameras, log cameras, to be able to create dailies or viewing or screening copies. You know, the Alexa Log C to 709 LUT, the Sony S-Log 2, S-Log 3 to 709 LUTs, the Canon C-Log to 709 LUT are just technical LUTs. They get you they get you without opinion from one point to the other. They're not adding look necessarily.
Well, the cool thing about that too is that they know exactly what the input is coming in too. I mean, that's the thing. That's what the key to doing all the LUT work is knowing what the input is and the output.
They know exactly what your output. They're like, we're going to get you from point A to point B. Assuming point A is correct, then you're going to get the correct point B output. Now, what I've seen people do is say, for example, get Blackmagic footage and throw the Alexa on it and go, I like the way it looks. And yeah, okay, yeah, great, but it's not a correct application. You're just kind of throwing stuff at a wall and seeing if it sticks, right? So that's one correct application. It's like the technical transfer of one color space to another, which I sometimes generally I use that for like dailies and stuff. I won't necessarily use that for the final grade because in the final grade I usually do some kind of hand crafted version of that. Another place I use LUTs is calibration LUTs, right? So when profiling a display and, you know, the display's controls can only get you so far, if you want to get, you know, those, you know, below one delta E values that are awesome, you know, on your display, it helps if you have if you're able to generate a LUT that's going to just get you the rest of the way and get your display spot on the money perfect. And then the third use of LUTs that I have is sometimes I'll have to develop looks for a specific purpose before the cut is done or before we're really to do the final thing when we're, for example, doing visual effects or stuff like that. So we kind of pre-develop looks and you want like a viewing LUT for the director to be able to sit with the VFX artist and evaluate what the image will probably look like when we finish it. And so I will usually work with a DP and director, develop a look for certain scenes, and pass those off to the VFX artist. Sometimes we do it specifically to a specific shot. So we'll be like, this LUT is for shot A, here's a LUT for shot B, here's a LUT for shot C, and they will apply it in their chain so they can look at it and then turn it off and give it back to me without the LUT applied so I'm able to then grade it however we need to.
So What do you think in terms of being able to develop looks for people, do you think it's better if somebody maybe made a DRX of a look instead of making a LUT for the look?
You mean if you're going to sell looks? I think that's probably a plus. It gives people more kind of room to finesse stuff around. But it also means you're giving away your secrets, right? You don't have, you have no, there's no... that you can look behind the curtain. There's no
right.
There's no magic trick there. You can see exactly what they're doing, and that's the trade-off, right? So I think Baselight was talking about they have their BLG,
right?
Which is similar to like a DRX. It just lets you carry through the grades, and then you can bring a BLG from a full Baselight into Baselight Editions and load the BLG, and it applies the grade. And at one point, they were talking about doing the equivalent of like a encrypted BLG or like a hidden BLG, where you could hide a lot of the stuff that you were doing. So that a person using it wouldn't be able to modify it or look at what you did. And that is a way for a more, say, secretive colorist to be able to share BLG grades without having to worry about his little special sauce getting out. I think that that has some appeal, and that's certainly interesting. I wouldn't mind it if Resolve had a kind of similar functionality.
I mean, it would be... It's. I think you still have the same problem where you don't know what the input is, because... I mean, because you could throw a lot of things on it, but it was like, well, what was the footage going in? Was it light? Was it dark? Was it? And so it's kind of tough to make some of those assumptions as well.
Or what temperature was it shot at?
Right.
Yes, absolutely. But I think the Baselight's thinking in that scenario was kind of similar to what my process is with LUTs and VFX, where you're just handing off something for somebody to sort of. Use in editorial or use in VFX
right.
as they're developing the look, the effect.
In terms of distributing DRX files, that's actually the way a lot of companies are doing it who are selling looks. You know, so there's a lot of LUTs that you can purchase, but then one set that I purchased for fun was, I guess, Motion VFX MLUKs for Resolve, which was actually pretty decent. I think it's about 90 different DRX files along with the DPX still image, and you load them in, and, you know, it's kind of a nice place if you're really... You know what's awesome for is client attend. If you have a basic idea about, you know, what you want to do, but not necessarily sure how to get there, you can go through those sorts of things with a director or a DP on a first sit down and just explore ideas, especially if they are not aware of what they want, you know? And usually when you start showing people some ideas, you're going to get one of two things. You're going to get a resounding yes, or you're going to get a resounding no. And so each of those is useful, you know? And so that's what I've done sometimes. Yeah, but, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting is that a popular idea that a lot of people in the community always say is, oh, why don't we create a place where we can share looks? And I don't know if there's a place that's really developed, you know, other than commercial offerings. I've never seen a place where people actually share looks. And sometimes I wonder why that is.
When we all used to color in Apple Color, there was a site that you could share grades, colorgrader.net. Is that what it was?
I don't remember the address. I was a Final Touch user. So before it was right. in Color. And but I mean I've just never been a big subscriber into those things. I always feel like it's kind of I like developing it myself because I like kind of experimenting and seeing you know where things go or where I can twist things or how I can shape stuff. I like seeing a lot of different looks, like seeing them and then taking those and kind of reinterpreting them or trying to recreate those. I find interesting. But I don't know, when I was a kid and we used to get like the Lego, you know, like Lego sets, and it would be like a model, like, you know, it'd be like the Back to the Future car or something, right? And they would have like instructions, and so everybody would like, did you guys do this? You'd immediately like build the model. I think I'd like start to kind of build the model, and then I'd be like, nah, I've got this other idea I want to do, and I'd find it much more interesting. And then I would have the Legos, but I would never build the thing that it was intended to be. I would always just be making my own thing. I think that mindset kind of applies to the way I develop looks too. Like when you mentioned the idea, Jason, of like, you know, when a client doesn't really know what to do, I just think like having the ability to throw 500 different things at them, like that to me is more trouble than kind of figuring out, okay, well, what's the story really trying to do here? What are we trying to say about these characters? What are we trying to say about this scene? What is the feeling you want to have? What's the emotion? And developing ideas based on that. I just find much more productive where if you just throw like, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? What do you think of this? They might like 10 of them, but it doesn't help make a decision, I think.
Well, I think the one thing that happens a lot, especially now, is that there are people who are in color sessions that have never been in color sessions before. And one of the things that I found at least is helpful is to start to understand a person's sensibility, you know, stylistically. And so I think you're fortunate, Juan, in that you're sitting down with some really educated people. But, you know, especially for people who are owner operators now, not only are they possibly new to the situation, but you also have a situation where their clients are new to the situation. And so, you know, it's just another option. I think one of the things I found was that if people were going for something, there was often this nice idea of, like, you know, both you and Josh have spoken of the bag of tricks. It's just another way to add a bag of tricks that can be useful for exploring ideas without spending the time to actually build it out. So let's say somebody likes the idea of highlight glow. Well, in those MLooks, there are some options with highlight glow. And let's say that the people are going for ethereal. And you're like, oh, maybe they mean highlight glow. And you can show it to them without having to spend 10 minutes building a really nice highlight glow. And that's where I think the productivity actually can increase. But I understand your comment about the idea of just, you know, shotgunning ideas when you could be trying to very sort of efficiently work your way towards something with good questions, you know, and hopefully getting good answers. But man, I mean, I've been in a lot of situations where people are like, you know, what is highlight glow? And you're like, all right, well, here's some highlight glow. And they're like, oh, hell yeah. Or they're like, oh, no, not really, you know.
Well, I think that highlight glow, that's a good example. I mean, I think that conversation would be like, you know, oh, I want it to feel dreamy, or I want it to feel timeless, or I want it to feel kind of romantic or soft, or, you know, you get feedback. You know, it's a little bit of a psychology session, right? You're just kind of like trying to, you're like the therapist. You're trying to figure out what's really bothering your patient. Like, you're trying to coax out the information. And I think a lot of times when I have clients in a session, I feel like they don't know how to vocalize what it is. I'm just like, you know, just throw words at me, man. Just whatever you're feeling, just tell me, because there might be something there that I'll latch onto and be able to kind of guide you. I think it's our job as colorists to sort of, it is our job to kind of be able to guide the client, the DP, the director, whoever, the filmmaker, whoever it might be, through the process and help them get to their own truth, you know.
Yeah, I think you know, even Resolve ships with some built-in looks in their gallery, and in the beginning they were really great to figure out how things actually work. Just having those there and going, oh, how does a highlight glow work? And you know, you throw it on at the end of your chain and you go, oh, okay, that's how it works.
And you can see the nodes and see how it's broken out. I think that's great. You know, I don't mean to dismiss, Jason, the value of like, of these looks as developments. I'm just giving my own kind of experience, my own opinion on the session, the way the session flows. But I that's not to say that isn't a really valid or effective way of kind of getting to the same place.
What do you guys think about the use of LUTs in editorial? Because that's kind of a hot new area.
Yeah. So, I mean, this gets back to, I think, the broader conversation, which is like, if you're using the LUT appropriately, like I mentioned, the idea of like, sometimes I'll develop grades with the DP and director before we get to the finishing session, and I'll hand those off as LUTs for VFX artists or maybe even editors, although that hasn't really come up. You know, as a way to kind of get the look in their version of the process, I think that's a really valid and great way to use LUTs. And I think the idea of, for example, like in Final Cut Pro X now, like when you bring in Alexa footage, it automatically applies that Alexa log C to 709 LUT on its own. It's like, oh, this is Alexa footage, it's in log, we're going to make it 709 so you can see it the right way. And I think that's a really valid and great way to kind of use that information. Where it gets a little troubling is when you start getting into like, well, you know, let's try and come up with some look for this whole scene. You know, I think like the SpeedGrade, Premiere has like the Lumetri plugins that you can do, and I think in their demo they've done a couple of things where they've taken a look, which is what it's a .look file, that's what they call it, which is the Lumetri, the SpeedGrade grade, and they've applied it as an adjustment layer over a whole scene. And they're just like, let's give the scene a look and see how it feels. And they just throw it over a bunch of different shots that aren't necessarily balanced and aren't necessarily, you know, the same kind of shot. And they're just throwing this as a kind of a blanket pill, like a cure-all. And, you know, getting kind of inconsistent results. You know, you don't get great results that way because you have to, you know... grade for the shot. You can't just grade for the scene. You know, you have to balance the shot and make it fit that shot and fit the framing and fit the what the levels are within that shot and what the temperature is and what the exposure is in that shot.
So in editorial, I think if it accomplishes one thing, it would be this is far and away the best thing that you could get from a LUT, is that people don't get married to the flat, washed out look. So as long as they have that, then everyone goes, is it really going to look this washed out, or is it going to look weird like that? And then, you know, in the process, in the monitoring, or somewhere, you know, in the timeline, it's done that transformation to it, then people won't come into the bay and go, you know, I did kind of like that, the way it looked like washed out like that. Why don't we leave that? Which would be bad.
That's bad. I do think that's and like the Final Cut Pro X application where it's automatically doing that for Alexa Log C, I think that's great. That's awesome.
It's going to save us from low-con.
Is it the same as people like forcing the phones to shoot horizontally instead of vertically? Is it like that?
Like you know, your phone should just, if you're trying to shoot a video like vertically, it should just like flash red and be like, don't do it. No. Turn it sideways.
I guess in terms of, other situations where LUTs might come into play, one of the things that's been happening a lot, you were speaking about calibration a little bit. So what do you think about some of these apps that are basically just creating a LUT and then people are sort of expected to put it into either like a display LUT in Resolve, or they're trying to use it in a Davio, or maybe even try to load it into a monitor? Do you think that that's going to become more commonplace now that that stuff has become accessible?
I mean, the pricing has become more accessible. I don't know if the technology has become significantly more accessible.
Yeah, that little Fuji box is super cheap, isn't it?
Yeah, it's $1,300, I think.
Compared to a Davio, I think that was like $5,000.
I have right. two of those guys. The Davio is an awesome, by the way. Like, have you guys ever worked with a Davio?
I've seen it before. I've never actually used one myself.
It's like two independent, like, 3G inputs and outputs, and you can put, like, you can basically load, like, two different 3D LUTs on it and have it applied, you know, through HDMI input, HDSDI input. Like, it's really kind of a wonder box, you know. It's got so much functionality. It's pretty cool. And it's a shame that it's, like, that's a defunct... you know, product now. I think the site is down too. Like, you can't even get the drivers anymore, which scares me a little bit because I need them in order to be able to use my Davios. The calibration LUT has existed for a fairly long time, like over a decade. People have been using calibration LUTs in one capacity or another. That's very much a tool, right? That's a means to an end. It's getting that display the last 5 yards to the end zone, right?
Are you using calibration LUTs to dial in your monitors, Josh or Juan?
We actually are not on ours. They're all just, you know, calibrated. Rec 709, and I know Juan, you have a lot different needs than we do as well.
Yes, I mean, we have projection, plasma, OLED, LCD. Yes, we're using LUTs a lot for calibration, and we also do. We'll develop like custom color spaces for shows, and so we'll have custom LUTs. Transform LUTs that we build out. We use LUTs a fair amount. It's never a LUT that I could put post on a public forum and be like, here guys, check out my LUT, it's my amazing new look. Like, that will never happen because it's developed for a specific shot or a specific display or a specific color space. It's not, you can't have a all-purpose LUT. LUTs aren't smart. They're very, 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 very dumb animals. If a LUT had an IQ, it would have an IQ of like 2. And because all it does is – and the reason why it's successful is because all it does is go 10-24, okay, that's 10-23 – 17, okay, that's going to be 19. Like, that's all the LUT does. And so the LUT doesn't go, is that 709? Is that P3? Is that Alexa log C? All right, then we want to go. It doesn't know any of those things. It just knows input and output. So if you don't know what that is, then you're not going to have the successful outcome.
So if people want to get into creating their own LUTs, I mean, I guess fundamentally you could do that with Resolve. So people could apply color changes to an image, probably with the idea of hopefully, you know, balancing that image first and then sort of, you know, I guess what you'd want to do is you'd want to start with a clean beginning point if you were creating LUTs that would hopefully be applicable in other situations. Is that the idea?
Well, that's the trick, isn't it? Like it's actually very, very difficult to do a LUT that you could really apply in other situations.
Yeah, I think that you'd be better served by just, you know, making your power grade library better personally.
Yeah. Well, what you can do is, you know, you can, first of all, you're a little bit limited in terms of what functions you can do with a LUT. So you can think of it as any of the kind of the primary grade functions, those work. The secondaries, as long as, you're not using a shape or a blur on your qualifier or sharpen or whatever, you can use noise reduction that you can forget about. What else can anything temporal you can forget about, like, you know, not going to happen. So you can with that in mind, you can build stuff and make it a LUT and share it with your buddy and you know, pass them around, and they may or may not work. It's definitely going to work on that shot, like whatever shot you develop that LUT on. It's that LUT is going to work on that shot in any Resolve station, right? So that one works, but beyond that, it gets a little bit iffy. It's kind of like applying, copying a grade from one shot to another. Is that grade going to work on every single shot? No, probably not.
In terms of situations where, you know, sort of film emulation LUTs have been really popular, do you think with film sort of, I guess, being more and more minimized in the, you know, post process, and then also for distribution, do you think that film emulation LUTs as a stylistic thing are going to give way to like more of a clean look where people won't be enamored necessarily with what film emulation LUTs did? Or do you think that that will always be something that will sort of live on as a body of creative intent, I guess, if that's the way you put it?
Sure. I think, well, one thing I've noticed is a lot of times when people want to do something that looks filmic, they think of bad film. Do you know what I mean? Like, they think of like film that's been washed out or underexposed or overexposed or is faded or has slightly scratches, a lot of grain. Mm. You know, they think of the things that we were really trying to get away from with film, right? If you were to look at a scan from the original camera, the OCN scan of a big budget film, you would have a very clean, very nicely balanced image, and it wouldn't look like what you think of as film. And I'm doing little air quotes with what today's sort of stylistic concept of film is. It's a really different beast. So I think as we get further and further away from that, and we get more and more removed from it, I think we start to see the aesthetics get more developed, right? It's like you look at videos online today, or you look at stuff on TV or commercials, and there's things that you can kind of vaguely see as being cinematic, but they're not really anymore. They're something else. They're very clean, or they're very, you know, they have these lifted blacks, but they have a lot of detail. They have, you know, they have these really interesting things going on. They have these washes and these pushes that I think we're kind of pushing the envelope a little bit. And so I think the aesthetic is changing. I don't think you're going to be so concerned about the film emulation LUT factor much longer. I think that's going to kind of wane in fashion, especially because once you're a little bit clever and you kind of know what you're doing, it's pretty easy to get something close to that on your own without all the caveats of a lot like quantization, which we haven't even gotten into yet.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think would be really interesting though is we're all applying this stuff in post without the DP or the director knowing what that might look like in the field. What would be really cool is if they could take, you know, one of these, if that's the overall plan, they wanted it to look like some sort of film stock, they could load those LUTs into the camera in the field so they could light it and shoot it specifically knowing that the output LUT was going to do what it was going to do. Because then at that point, you would know what the input and the output were going to be, and you could light it accordingly.
Well, and that's where you're getting to now with these monitors and Fujifilm. Like, monitors now are being able to have multiple LUTs loaded in memory, and you can try out different LUTs.
Right.
I've done situations where we've had the DP and the director come in before the shoot really started, where they had some test footage, and we've kind of played around with things and developed a look that then I spit out LUTs and targeted at, say, a stop above and a stop below that stop, and a little bit warmer and then a little bit cooler. And so I've given them a few variations on that look, and they've had that on set to sort of pull up and try a couple of variations on it so they could sort of see how it would feel. That's been somewhat successful, and I think that's a pretty legit use of a LUT, right? Where we're targeting a known thing. In that case, it's like Alexa Log C, and I know that the output's 709, and so we're just figuring out kind of what the feel of the show is going to be.
Right.
Do you think that there's going to be a time where, you know, LUTs will outlive their usefulness with the way ACES is progressing and you have IDTs and ODTs and stuff like that, where that will become the new transform device?
Yeah, you have this CTL now. It's a color transform language, which is like the ACES's little roll your own functionality. It's kind of cool. And in fact, Lightspace just added the ability to generate a CTL from within Lightspace. The thing that they're doing is actually basically embedding that LUT within the CTL. So if you looked at that CTL, you would see the straight up LUT math embedded within it, versus the more kind of mathematical transforms that those CTLs are. It's basically a programming language. And so you can say things like, if a value is below this, use this process. If a value is above that, use that process. You can do cool things like that.
Wouldn't it be great if there was a resolve node for that?
for a CTL? I mean, it would be great if...
No, just a note, like, because I know that Peter Doyle developed a lot of interesting looks based on analyzing every pixel in a frame and then doing different calculations based on that. Is that right?
Once you abstract an image and you start turning it into pure math, there's some really interesting doors that open up.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can have, you know, you can have things like if-then statements that evaluate pixels or groups of pixels or the overall image. Or
right. I mean, to some degree, that's what we're doing with transform modes, too. We're doing all kinds of math based on the input and output of those images as well, too. So
that's a more simplistic kind of version of it, where it's just doing this one function as opposed
right.
to being able to mathematically yeah. do any function, yeah.
But it doesn't have that same logic built into it that you're talking about.
Right.
Well, the one thing, too, is that he's very interested in matrices, and he does a lot of very high-end color science with his projects. And if you listen to some of the podcasts, like Josh, you actually posted all the FX PhD color grading-related mm-hmm. podcasts.
Right.
And, you know, there was kind of like this joke, the Peter Doyle interview, you know, be careful if you listen to it, your head might explode. A big component of that was how he describes their use of, like, well, I guess, you know what, he talks about suppression LUTs, but I believe that he also talks a lot about using matrices, and he does very utilitarian things with them. So for instance, if you take a look at some of the scenes that they describe where they're in very closed environments, and because of the way that the set or the rooms in some of these fantastical stories that he's grading are very small, these sort of medieval sort of cabins and stuff that they have, they run into difficulty where, because of the lighting, there's, let's say, a preponderance of yellow or green or something like that. And it's a practical issue, and he's really into solving the sort of the negatives of those onset conditions with LUTs and matrices so that he has a more idealized beginning point for grading, you know. And it's really interesting to hear him apply that stuff because he's really going for it at a really minute level. And when you understand the lengths that he goes to on his projects, you just feel like a laggard. You're like, I don't love my project enough, you know, or something.
I just today I was working on a project where it was kind of a small room, and there was a kind of an overwhelming a tungsten lit, and there was an overwhelming warmth and kind of yellowness to the light, and I was using a matrix to kind of pull some of that out and get more separation into that space. I mean, those things are more, they have to be more crafted to the situation than I think a LUT, a general right. purpose LUT could be, you know.
Overall, I guess if people wanted to learn to use LUTs in a more, you know, what we'll call professional manner, you know, I guess, you know, the good starting point would be things like, you know, properly transforming their camera footage to a good starting point, like the Alexa log to Rec 709, and start applying that in their projects more and more, right?
I would say that properly using LUTs shouldn't be a goal. It should just be something you do. You know, it's kind of like handling a scalpel for a surgeon isn't necessarily the goal. The goal is completing the surgery. The scalpel and the handling of the scalpel is a tool and a function to get to that goal. So you should really think of LUTs as kind of a tool that you evaluate on a case-by-case basis. Is this an efficient way to get from point A to point B? Is this tool the right tool for that task? Has it been designed for this task, or am I misappropriating the tool?
And with that, we're going to end this episode of The Coloristos. It's been a good talk about LUTs and all of that. So I will end by saying my name is Josh Petok. I am a colorist in Los Angeles as well. And you can see me on Lift Gamma Gain or check out my website, www.joshpetok.com, or on Twitter, @JoshPetok.
And I'm Jason Myris. I'm a colorist in Los Angeles. You can find me on Lift Gamma Gain. I'm also on Twitter @JasonMyris, and you can find me at jasonmyris.com.
And I'm Juan Salvo. I'm a colorist in New York City. You can find me on the internet at juansalvo.com, or you can see my DI and color grading shop, The Color Space, at thecolorspace.com. That's with a U, C-O-L-O-U-R, the fancy British way. You can also see me on Twitter @J_Salvo. Thanks so much for listening. We hope we didn't totally let you out.